Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. A peek at the Latin in Pope Pius XI's first speech over Vatican Radio. Shedding light on the Tridentine Rite. But first, Pope Benedict XVI says natural law does not depend on the will of the legislator. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. You may have heard Pope Benedict XVI decried the loss of firm moral foundation in law and scientific research when he met on Monday, 12th of February, with a group of very special people. In fact, from the 12th to the 14th of February here in Rome, a conference is taking place focusing on natural law and morality. A conference my colleague Catherine Smybert, who has particular interest in this issue, is following for us. Stay tuned as she reports, beginning, of course, with Pope Benedict's words.
In his address to the international group of scientists, lawyers, philosophers and theologians, Pope Benedict stressed the urgency that natural law be deeply considered and that ways might be discovered to incorporate it better into our contemporary world.
È fuori dubbio che viviamo un momento di straordinario sviluppo.
The Holy Father warned that if natural law is not respected, then life, family and society become victims of ethical relativism. Pope Benedict pointed out the contradictions of the present time, characterized by technological progress, saying we see all the great advantages of this progress, but we also increasingly note the threats of destruction of the gift of nature. He added that there's another danger, less visible but no less disturbing, the method, which allows us to increasingly know the rational structures of matter, which makes us ever more incapable of seeing the source of this rationality. Creative reason. The Holy Father also pointed out the duty to seek the truth, a necessary assumption of any authentic maturity of the person.
Che ci permette di conoscere sempre più le strutture razionali della materia.
One of the participants at the papal audience and speaker at the conference is Father Terence Kennedy, a Redemptorist professor at the Pontifical Alphonsianum University here in Rome. He underlined a few other points the Pope made.
He discussed a little bit about the scriptures and St. Paul's reference that, without using the expression, the law being written in the heart. Well, it's God's law from creation that's been written in the human heart, and then Revelation comes along to clarify that. He went on then to make some points from Gaudium et Spes about marriage and the family, and that they are what we'd call natural institutions. They have a basis in what God did in creation and what he wants from creation, and in that sense they belong to natural law. And then the last thing I remember about the Pope's discourse, among many points, was the encouragement to study these problems and to make the Church's teaching actual.
The conference is examining both the perspectives and problems surrounding the issue of natural law. Father Kennedy explains its importance.
It is so much part of us, but it can be obscured and it can be corroded away. And when you get, if you like, bad morality and bad moral custom and it gets rooted in a society, you actually begin to lose your grip on these principles. Even do good and avoid evil. And when you get on that sort of open sea where there's no point of reference anymore, that's why I think we've got a crisis at the moment. Yeah, the Magisterium of the Church has intervened on this type of issue over the last 20 years, in Encyclicum Veritatis Splendor, then Fides et Ratio. And this convention is an attempt to look at that and to see if it can be received better and penetrate more, say, into everyday Catholic teaching. at various levels.
The Church considers natural law ethically binding, and as Pope Benedict says, it doesn't depend on the will of the legislator. This is where the application of natural law becomes imperative to our contemporary world. The Holy Father uses the examples of laws threatening families and society, alluding to legislation permitting abortion and euthanasia. He says no law made by man can subvert the law written by the Creator without society being dramatically injured at the base of its foundation. The Pope specifically speaks of the need to defend human life from its beginning to its natural end, and of the need to defend marriage. The conference is going on to explore the epistemological problems about how natural law can be worked out in thought and logic, as well as examining how natural law impinges upon civil law. And though there are lots of perspectives being analysed, Father Kennedy says that the conference and the Pope feel the duty to affirm once again that not everything that is scientifically feasible is also ethically licit.
It covers a very wide range of issues in 2.5 days. Sure, there'll be lots of points of view in the group there. Even among Catholic thinkers, it's the last 40, 50 years has seen attempts to try and formulate natural law in different ways, as often enough as a set of human goods or what they call the person adequately considered. What I think, though, you have to get back to a very fundamental level, goes back to God as creator, and that he made the person, he made the person good and for goodness with himself. Now, I think that just the discussion of what's good in the here and now is not sufficient. You need to look at the whole vocation of man, if you like, of humanity, and that is a vocation.
My thanks there go to Catherine Smybert's guest for sharing with us his expertise. He's Father Terence Kennedy, a Redemptorist who's a professor at the Pontifical Alphonsionum University here in Rome. And of course, many thanks to Catherine herself. Meanwhile, I'd like to move on in the broadcast and share with you an insight into what it means to work in the Vatican, like I do. When you work in these circles, there's some questions you frequently get asked. For example, on many an occasion during the past months, I've been quizzed as to whether I've heard if the Tridentine Rite is going to be reintroduced. It's an issue that seems to set alight the interest of many Catholics. Among these, the nostalgics who wish to return to the old rite, and those who feel instead rather strongly that the reintroduction is right off track. Well, I certainly don't have a crystal ball, so I can't satisfy people's curiosity and foresee the future as regards the outcome of this debate, should there be any. But what I do have is a microphone to help me find out more about this Tridentine Rite. Also because beyond those who vehemently take sides for or against it, there are also those like myself who simply don't know too much about it, thinking at times that the debate is merely about language and not mentality. So what I did was take my microphone along to interview a liturgist and sacramental theologian, the Superior General of the Viatorians, Father Mark Francis. And if you stay tuned, you can hear what he told me about the Tridentine Rite. Tridentine, is that how you pronounce it? The Tridentine Mass?
Sure. The so-called Tridentine Mass is kind of a shorthand way of referring to the liturgy. The technical term is the Liturgy of Pius V, the Missal of Pius V that was promulgated in 1570.
It was supposed to last forever.
And it was expected to last forever in a real sense.
It lasted till 40 years ago.
And it lasted about 400 years, until 1970, more or less. And so it was the only Eucharistic liturgy that the Latin Rite of the Roman Catholic Church had for those 400 years. But it's important to keep in mind that the Latin Rite is not the only rite within the Roman Catholic Church, that there are 22 other rites of the Church, 22 other different ways of praising God through the Eucharist, with other languages, with other calendars of saints and other practices. And so the diversity of the Catholic Church, we need to really reappropriate now that we live in a very multicultural world, and just to understand that the Latin way of doing things is not the only way.
In other words, it's not just a question of using Latin. But there was an advantage in the Tridentine Mass. It was available to everybody in the old days because of the use of the Latin language.
It's true that the parts of the priest were all in Latin, and they were invariable. They never changed. But even during that 400 years when the so-called Tridentine Rite was in use, the way in which people worshipped was very different. Take, for example, the difference between a sumptuous Mass celebrated in Austria with full choir and processions, those kind of thing, and a Mass celebrated furtively in the hedgerows of Ireland during the penal laws. The experience of going to Mass, even though the words were the same and the supposedly the rite was the same, was extremely different. And so a lot of our cultural differences in terms of how we understand worship really begin during this time when supposedly the Mass is celebrated in the exact same way throughout the world.
The word Tridentine presumably comes from Trent.
It comes from the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent, which was celebrated in the 16th century, mandated the Holy See to issue a missal purged of the abuses of the Middle Ages, because there are several problems that pertain to the celebration of the Eucharist during the Middle Ages that the Council of Trent sought to rectify. And so this missal, promulgated during the pontificate of Pius V in 1570, was indeed that missal which was purged of all those abuses.
So it's incorrect to say that the Tridentine Mass was celebrated for 1,500 years?
Oh, that's very inaccurate. Certainly the tradition of the various prayers of the Missal of Pius V, or the so-called Tridentine Mass, go back to, some of them go back as far as the 5th century, 4th and 5th century. Compositions were put together, collated, for the use of parishes here in Rome, for example. And you see evidences of it today, even in our translation of some of the hallowed prayers of the Roman Rite, for example, the first Eucharistic prayer. The list of saints in the first Eucharistic prayer are saints that were particularly beloved to the Romans. The same thing of the naming of the various popes in the list of saints also indicates that this was a very local prayer that was later made universal.
The Tridentine Mass wasn't actually banned after Vatican II, was it?
Well, the Tridentine Mass, when the promulgation of the new missal took place, was in a certain sense overshadowed, because there was never a time in the history of the Church where we had two official rites. Holy Father John Paul II gave an indult to people who were so attached to the old rite that for their spiritual benefit, he enabled priests to offer this Mass for them so that they wouldn't be discouraged, that they could continue going to Mass in the old way. It was meant as a kind of a means of helping people in their spiritual life, especially those older people who found it hard to adapt. Because that was a sense of the indult that was given in the 1980s.
So what happened with Lefebvre then? Was he given an indult? But he was excommunicated for different purposes, no?
Well, I think it's important to understand that whether or not one accepts the Roman Rite or the new liturgy of Vatican II is an indication if does one accept the teachings of the Ecumenical Council of Vatican II as well. And in the case of Archbishop Lefebvre, he not only rejected the Mass, the liturgy of Vatican II, or the Missal of Paul VI, he basically rejects the Vatican Council. Vatican Council II. And so as a result, the product of this council is indeed the liturgy, and so it was for him kind of a sign or a symbol of his rejection of what he considered to be a deviation in the history of the Church. That is also, to a certain extent, the case of some of the other groups that have broken from the Roman Catholic Church and who insist on celebrating the liturgy according to the Tridentine fashion. The basic problem with all this is that it's a doctrinal problem as well as a liturgical problem. And those who refuse to accept the new liturgy and consider it illegitimate basically also consider Vatican II illegitimate.
Is part of the Tridentine Rite for the priest to celebrate with his back to the congregation?
Indeed. That's part and parcel of the way in which the rite is celebrated. It's a question of mediation in a certain sense, where if you look at the Tridentine Rite, the priest was the mediator between God and the people, and he stood between the altar and the people and that kind of represents that kind of a mediation. After Vatican II, we turn the altars around, and the priest faces the people with the table between them, in real sense saying that this table is a common table, belongs to all of the Christians gathered, and therefore the presence of Christ is in our midst, not being drawn down upon the altar from heaven above. In a real sense, that shift exemplifies well some of the teachings of the Second Vatican Council.
So what's the interest in talking about the Tridentine Mass right now, if some people are allowed to celebrate the Tridentine Mass anyway?
Well, I think they're allowed to celebrate it only by way of exception, and not by way of just a general way of celebration. I think that that particular discipline is rather important because, indeed, we only have one rite, the Latin rite of the Roman Catholic Church, and that is the rite that was approved by Paul VI, the Vatican II liturgy, which best exemplifies or best illustrates who we are as church, what we believe today as Christians in terms of our understanding of church, understanding of sacraments. All those things are encompassed in the celebration itself. Part of the problem today, I still think, even 40 years after the Council, was that the way in which the liturgical changes were introduced and these changes in custom and this kind of thing, we didn't do it very well. We didn't give very much catechesis. We simply, from one day to the other, we changed the liturgy without giving people time to really think about what these changes might mean and how, indeed, that they illustrate the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. And so as a result, there are some people, and many of those people found themselves, in a certain sense, disagreeing with the Church, who find themselves outside the Church because they don't understand why the changes were made.
Does one say Tridentine Mass or Tridentine Rite?
Well, you know, there's the Tridentine Rite of Mass. There's also the Tridentine Rites of the sacraments can be celebrated in the Tridentine way. And, for example, you know, when we could celebrate a funeral with the Tridentine Rite, which is always it would be the Dies Irae, for example, which is the Days of Wrath. And it's a long Latin hymn that was sung at every funeral that speaks of the Days of Wrath and the Second Coming of Christ and the Judgment and all that. All that was changed with Vatican II. It's a beautiful hymn, the Dies Irae, but it's also very, very scary in a real sense. And so part of the liturgical reform after Vatican II was to take another look at how these sacraments or, in this case, the funeral was celebrated, to talk about Christian hope, Christian life, how the gospel itself gives us a cue in terms of understanding what happens to us at death. That's not to say that the Dies Irae was illegitimate, that it wasn't a good thing necessarily for its time, but that now, after several centuries of Christian living, we have another attitude or another way of understanding a Christian death and how to celebrate it.
I think you'd like to add on the Tridentine Mass.
The Tridentine Mass served the Church well for several centuries. But in a real sense, after the Council of Trent, the Tridentine Mass was established in such a way that it could only be celebrated in one particular way. The rubrics or the ceremonial directives were invariable. It was hedged around by law, and it was estimated, for example, that a priest, in celebrating the Mass, could sin hundreds of ways. And some of those ways were mortal sins. And that's in the introduction to the Tridentine Mass. We have a different attitude today in terms of how we understand the liturgy and how the priest and the people need to celebrate it. We don't emphasize the fact that if you deviate from the rubrics that there's a sin involved, though I think we probably have all experienced the fact that there are times where you know that the priest is sinning liturgically if he deviates too much from what the basic rite is supposed to be. The Tridentine Rite, which was in vigor for 400 years, in a certain sense was an anomalous time in the Church. Because before that time, the rites, the liturgy of the Mass, liturgy of the various sacraments, developed and changed over the course of each century. It was only with Trent in 1570 and the possibility of making everything uniform through the use of the printing press that made the liturgy fixed and stable.
There's not only the use of Latin in the Tridentine Mass, there's Hebrew as well, and then there's lots of silence in the Tridentine Mass, no?
Well, I mean, there's Aramaic, there's Hebrew, there's Greek. I once gave a talk about, they gave me the title for this talk, Whatever Happened to the Kyrie? And someone stood up at the end of my talk and said, yes, we want to bring back the Latin Mass. We want to be able to sing Kyrie again. Well, Kyrie is Greek. It's not Latin. it comes from that interchange between the Eastern and Western churches. Rite itself, the traditional rite, was something that, for example, in the Holy Holy, and they're talking about returning to this phraseology of the
Sanctus.
Holy, or the Sanctus, Holy Holy Holy, Lord God Sabaoth.
Sanctus.
Rather than Lord God of power and might. Sabaoth is Hebrew for God of the armies. The translation is always going to be limping in terms of how we're going to understand God. But there's an instance of that even in the ancient Latin where they preserved certain words from Hebrew and from Greek.
Thanks there go to liturgist and sacramental theologian, Superior General of the Viatorians, Father Mark Francis, for so generously sharing with us his expertise. And now on a totally different note, it's time to mark a special anniversary, that of the inauguration of our radio station back on the 12th of February 1931, exactly 76 years ago. I do this by quizzing our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist, about the first speech broadcast on our radio station. In Latin, of course. Our radio station was founded by Pius XI on the 12th of February 1931, right?
Beautiful.
I dug out from the Acta Apostolica Sedis. I tell you, I had a little bit of trouble finding the Pope's first speech on our radio station, which was in Latin. I've had a little bit of trouble finding the Latin version. Not in sound, but in the actual text itself. What I found really interesting about this speech is how it's divided into categories. Basically, the Pope is speaking to all kinds of different categories. He starts by addressing creation, no?
Yeah.
He says,
Deus Christus imperat, which is still, you know, the theme song.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the first words that were transmitted.
Christus vincit, Christus regnat.
Christus imperat. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was when talks were for a wireless. And how do you translate the word wireless?
Sine filis.
So why do we call it radio then?
Radiare is to, like, on the spokes of a wheel. You know, that's radiare. Radii are the spokes of a wheel. So to send out a message like the spokes on a wheel is to radiate. It's all Latin.
The text of the first radio message, I've been told, was written in Latin by Pope Pius XI himself. Is that possible, do you think?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
And he said, listen, O heavens, to that which I say. Listen, O earth, listen to the words which come from my mouth. Is that what he said?
Where the heavens? Audite hic omnes gentes, all you people, listen to these things. With ears, perceive all of you people who are dwelling on this earth. Together, all together, the rich and the poor. May you and the islands hear, and people pay attention from far away. Oh, it's glorious. I don't know where you got the heavens from, but that's all right.
The passage we always hear, and when we use the first broadcast, we always use the first words, qui arcano de consilio. What does all that mean? Qui arcano de
consilio? We who by a secret plan of God, Sergedimus,
in loco,
follow up in the place of the Prince of the Apostles? Got the idea?
Yeah. Eorum nempe quorum doctrina.
Okay. Namely, of those apostles whose teaching and preaching by divine command has been destined to all peoples and to all creation. Oh, it's glorious.
So,
eorum, and we who are...
Et predicatio, so we said, eorum nempe quorum doctrina.
Yes, and of those people, namely, whose teaching and preaching...
Et by predicatio.
By divine command, Iussu Divino, destinata est, has been destined to all peoples and to all creation.
Ad omnes gentes et ad omnem creaturam.
Oh. Et, and look, and he's going on with the radio. And we who first, in the very place, are able to enjoy... Ope, okay, mira sane ope marconiana. And by this marvelous Marconian help. That's the radio.
Yeah. Where is help? Which word is
well,
it?
Well, ope, with the resources of the radio.
Ad omnia et ad omnes primo nos convert.
Okay, we turn ourselves to all things and to all people first. Hic et infra, here and below, I don't know, the sacred text helping us. We say, ah, here you are, oh, heavens, listen to the things which I say, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Mm. Oh, glorious.
How does this Latin compare to today's Latin?
This is much better than ours.
You wouldn't translate like this, would you?
No, because he wrote in Latin. Now we're translating. We are translating from another language into Latin, and this is artificial. This is real.
The Pope Pius XI speaks about the Ope Marconiana, the work of Marconi, in other words, the radio.
Yes.
Marconi spoke in Italian.
Yes. But he says, we are able to enjoy... to enjoy and to use, of course, the marvelous help of Marconi.
Because Marconi spoke before the Pope, no? And he said...
I don't know the story, really.
He said, I have the highest honor of announcing that in only a matter of seconds, the Supreme Pontiff, Pope Pius XI, will inaugurate the radio station of the Vatican City State.
Oh, how exciting.
The electric radio waves will transport to all the world his words of peace and blessing.
Marvelous. Good.
How'd you say all that in Latin?
Mi sumo honori est annunciare paucissimis omnino momentis pontificem supremum pium undecimum inauguraturum esse Stationem Radiophonicam Urbis Vaticane. It's glorious.
Warm thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.